The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off in our books section, The Big Messy Secret Behind Every Elizabeth Strout Novel. The author of the 107th Oprah's Book Club pick, Tell Me Everything, and the 82nd pick, Olive Again, shares an unexpected secret about her writing process. This article is by Elizabeth Strout. I like mess. This is a confession and a true one. I have always been this way. I do not like dirt. I can't stand dirt. But I do seem to like mess. This drove my mother wild throughout my youth. Every time she stepped into my room, clothes were everywhere. Even now, if there is a blanket on the couch, I will walk by it without bothering to fold it. It's just the way I am. I know people, and I wish I had a crumb of this quality, who could not walk by that rumpled blanket without folding it up each time. I have friends who are writers with the most pristine offices I have ever seen. Nice desks, beautiful bookcases, rugs on the floor, and flowers on a table. Everything is always very organized. And I have heard some of them say that if anything is out of place, they cannot work. This is inconceivable to me. What I mean is the amount of concentration for the likes of me to keep the place so perfect would take up all my energy and I would have none left to write. I have always been a very messy writer, even as I tried with a tiny bit of success to keep a tidy house. For years I worked at our dining room table, and my daughter, as a little girl, would often eat breakfast from a cereal bowl placed upon a pile of manuscripts. She never complained, the sweet thing. I suspect for her it was normal. Mommy, she would say when she got home from school each day, did you find an agent? And I would say, no. And she would say so cheerfully, you will. Honestly, what a sweet child she was. The point is this. When I finally reached the stage where I had more room to write, I still filled the place with pages and pages of handwritten stuff, much of it crossed out, some of the pages crumpled and on the floor. And what wasn't on the floor was everywhere, on the table, on any surface in the room. Here is a true story. When I wrote Olive Kitteridge, I sat down one day and wrote the last page of the book. I had not even written, or even thought about, the story that came before that page. I had no idea at that time that Olive's husband would have a stroke, that she would meet another man. But months and months later, as I began to work on that last chapter, I thought, wait, I have the ending to this someplace. And I rummaged through all my papers and found it, handwritten on a small notebook page by itself, with a remark written on the upper corner. Ending? And there it was, just waiting. The end page of the book. I did not even have to rewrite it. I used to think I was lucky to have found that last page, but now I think that I probably subconsciously knew where it was all along. Because although that was the most dramatic case of such a thing happening, I have noticed that I usually know where something is when I need it, even if there are many, many papers on top of it. Who knows why our minds work the way they do? You might know, but I don't really. My job is to accept that this is apparently the way I came. Because if the mess makes me anxious, nothing makes me more anxious than the thought of cleaning it up. There's a book that accompanies this article. It's Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout. If you're interested in purchasing it, it's $21 at Amazon. $28 at bookshop.org and $27 at Walmart. This next article is in Wellness. My friend is the pediatric cancer whisperer. This summer, I needed her. September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, the perfect time for a Gretchen Witt appreciation story. This article is by Alyssa Shalasky. I have 17 Stephanies saved in my phone, an inexplicable and yet delightful phenomenon, as I happen to love them all. But there is only one Stephanie whose call I will always answer. Why? Because she's a busy, successful working mom of three, and if she's ringing, it must be important. Also, she's my favorite of the Stephs, and I'd never screen her. In the beginning of the summer, not only did my favorite Stephanie call, but my favorite Stephanie was crying. Her daughter's close friend, a 9-year-old little girl named Ileana, was dying. She had cancer, Ewing sarcoma. She had gotten better, then suddenly worse, and now her parents were preparing for the unimaginable. It was likely the end of her life. There were no words, until Stephanie said the magic words, "Do you think your friend from Cookies for Kids Cancer might be able to help?" If you thought I was bragging about my wealth of good Stephanies, you haven't heard me talk about my beautiful friend Gretchen Witt. Gretchen is the founder of Cookies for Kids Cancer, an organization she started when her 2-year-old son, Liam, a precious little angel who wanted to be a chef, was diagnosed with cancer and should have lived to be 100 years old, but died at age 6. Gretchen converted her unspeakable grief into unrelenting action by pouring everything she had into Cookies for Kids Cancer. How does it work? Not unlike a venture capitalist, she provides the seed money for the most promising research that has the best chance of helping kids in the shortest period of time possible, as chosen through recommendations from Cookies Independent Medical Advisory Board. Grant requests are reviewed using the same rigorous criteria as that used by the National Cancer Institute, but the money gets into the hands of researchers in about 90 days. After all, kids don't have time to wait. The money is raised via Cookies, which are available 24/7, and direct 100% of the proceeds to the mission. Anyone looking for a great gift that gives back? Via grassroots events like bake sales, so far there have been more than 17,000 taking place in every state and 28 countries. And of course, through donations. Please give. Just last week, Gretchen found out that one of the grants is now a trial for a type of brain tumor that has a waiting list of kids hoping to enroll. Of course, Cookies is trying to figure out how to provide more funding to get kids off the waiting list. Bottom line, in Liam's honor, Gretchen keeps sick kids alive. I worship Gretchen. I go to anything she invites me to, especially when free Christina Tosi sweets are involved. She has the most inspiring parties that all the celebrities flock to. Hi, Paul Rudd, me again. I flirt with all her famous chefs. Hi, Dan Kluger. Hi, Missy Robbins. But until I connected Stephanie with Gretchen, I honestly had no clue just how powerful she really is. Here's what happened next. I put my two friends on a text. Within seconds, Gretchen was in combat mode. What exactly is the diagnosis? Who are the doctors? How is the pain? I'll be very real here and tell you that I could not read the hundreds of emails and texts that followed between Gretchen, Stephanie, and Ileana's incredible mom. I have 2 young kids. Maybe I am weak, but it was too hard for me. While Gretchen pinged the world's best doctors, She has a level of medical access that exists only on a Shonda Rhimes series, and zoomed in on the most cutting-edge trials and treatments, I looked away, praying for a positive outcome. Ultimately, there was nothing anyone can do, and while our Brooklyn community wept and Ileana's family faced their darkest days, Gretchen quietly, sturdily, reliably showed up. She was there, truly there, for everyone. I hope I never have to see Gretchen Witt in action like that again. But I had to write about what it means to have a friend who saves people. It was my profound honor to see her soar. She is a real-life superhero. And I'll bet good money and excellent cookies that Liam, up above, agrees. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're over in relationships. The best marriage advice we've ever gotten. Crowdsourced by Oprah Daily readers and shared for the greater good. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Is there a piece of marriage advice you were given that stuck with you? A North Star to guide you through the highs and lows and twists and turns of being together? We asked you, the Oprah Daily community, for advice you've held on to through the years, words you'd passed on to newlyweds, and wisdom for couples weathering a rough patch. And if you're in that rough patch, here are the best questions to ask to get closer to your spouse, ones to ask before calling it quits, and unexpected ways to save your marriage. Plus, books to read for a good marriage. A conversation between a couple's therapist and a divorce lawyer, and Oprah's advice for newlyweds. Two become one. Remember that you are not just marrying the person. Each of us comes with a different family culture, and you and your spouse are bringing two different cultures together to create a new one. This was such helpful advice as my spouse and I started married life, and I continued to value that advice as we navigate how to thrive in married life almost 40 years later. Olivia F. Know who you really are. Have your own personal life goals and have a personal financial plan, especially when everything is going well. What I have also learned on this journey is that our wants and needs change along the way. Page A, 60s. Married in 1994. Make sure each of you continues to embrace your individuality by engaging in fun activities that you share with family and or friends and outside of your spouse's interests. Alexander L., married in 1985. Your marriage experience will be unlike anyone else's. Don't compare. Marriage will reveal you to yourself, to your partner, and vice versa as time goes on. The beautiful, challenging uniqueness is only yours to share. Eddie R., 61, married in 1995. In a long-term, committed marriage, no one gets to be 100% themselves. When you realize your partner is troubled by something you are doing or not doing, consider if you're diminishing the relationship for your partner and be willing to make some changes. On the flip side, when you see your partner's ingrained behaviors that are unlikely to change, if it's something you can live with, stop trying to change it. Bend when you can to provide more value to your partner. Accept your partner's idiosyncrasies as much as you can. Jean A., 68, married in 2006 and together since 1999. My older sister told me that marriage is not a 50-50 relationship. Sometimes you give 90% and your partner gives 10%. The next day you might give 20 and they give 80. As long as it evens out. Taylor B. For better or for worse. My parents were married 66 years until my mom died. Her advice was, never go to bed mad or hurt. Ruth L., 80, married in 1965. Some say never go to bed angry. Nonsense. I say take a deep breath, get some sleep, think about it, and then come back together to discuss. This has saved me from saying the wrong things and being overly upset because I was so tired. Lucy B., 50, married in 2001. The best piece of marriage advice comes from my mom. If you're mad at your partner, don't tell your friends all the details. You'll be over it in an hour or day, but your friends will never forget it, especially if you are telling them in the heat of the moment, in anger. I have honored that throughout my almost 27-year marriage and am so glad I did. Isabel T., 54, married in 1997. My mother told me, don't make it bigger than it has to be. Marriage is the long game, and we have to keep the big picture in mind. If we fixate and ruminate on the small things, we will let ourselves take them too seriously. Elizabeth L., 65, married in 1987. Maintain your kindness and compassion during disagreements. In other words, avoid fighting dirty and using low blows during disagreements. For example, never weaponize information your spouse shared with you during vulnerable, intimate moments. A marriage should be an emotional sanctuary. Nina G., 48, married in 2010 and together since 2003. When you're going through rough times and wondering about your commitment, write down all the reasons you married your partner and the reasons you love them. Even after 44 years, I try to take note of all the little things he does every day that say, I love you. Louise H., 65, married in 1980. When my husband was leaving rehab, we met with a marriage counselor. He drew a three-legged stool and said, marriages run into trouble when the third leg of the stool becomes more important than your partner. For my husband, it was alcohol. But I was shocked to realize I had one too, my son. I could no longer see my husband as bad and myself as good. We are still grateful for that transformational moment more than 7 years later. Ella R., 51, married in 2008. Love is patient, love is kind. The 70/30 rule. If you are satisfied in your marriage 70% of the time, it's worth continuing. Don't give up on marriage too quickly because you think it should always be problem-free. Lee H., 70, married in 1979. Your partner is not a mind reader. Don't think they don't want to know what you are thinking or feeling. They do. You just need to tell them. I personally find it helpful to take some time to myself to figure out what I want to say. This helps keep the temperature down. Kelly P. My grandparents were married for over 50 years. They told me and my husband, always aim to do the right thing. When I've wanted to respond to pettiness with some of my own, I've chosen to do the right thing. Serena D., 40, married in 2011. Assume your partner's intentions are good any and every time something rubs you the wrong way or you don't agree on something. Disagreements will go much more smoothly when you assume the best and become curious instead of accusatory. Jane S., 49, married in 2022. Never volunteer each other for activities. When something comes up that would impact your spouse, always ask them first before agreeing. From having your in-laws come over for a visit to community events, always ask. Rachel M., 48, married in 2009. Diane Sawyer said, a good marriage is a contest of generosity. My late husband was one of the most generous people I have ever known. I knew I probably couldn't beat him in generosity, but I sure could try. Not only did he appreciate my effort, but being more generous also reinforced my gratitude for our marriage. It was a competition we both won. Joanna W., 52, married in 1997. This article comes from Wholeness. Why I Cut Off All My Hair. The author of City of Girls and Big Magic talks about how she made the bold decision to break out the clippers and find her own version of beauty. This article is by Elizabeth Gilbert. Sometime in the middle of last winter, in the middle of my 50s, I got my hands on some clippers and shaved my head down to a velvety stubble. It was something I'd been dreaming about for years. And by years, I mean decades. I can still remember an article I read in the Village Voice way back in the late 1980s about women shaving their heads as an act of both liberation and beauty. This was during the height of Sinead O'Connor's popularity, and I suppose her iconic example gave permission to many other women to get rid of their hair as well. There were a series of photos of all these women with buzzed and bald heads, and to me, they all looked stunning. I remember many of the interviewees using the word cleansing to describe the act, and one woman said that the ritual of shaving her head every week made her feel not only powerful and healthy, but as if her life was suddenly in perfect order. "Shaving your head is like going to the gynecologist and the dentist on the same day," she said. And the fact that I can still remember that quote after 35 years is an indication of how compelling I found the subject. I have always been attracted to the idea of buzzing my head because I have had difficult hair my whole life. Or at least that's what I was told ever since I can remember. Every woman with difficult hair has a different difficult hair story, but mine goes like this. My hair is a chaotic combination of frizzy and straight, dry and oily. My hair is thin, but there's a lot of it, and it can easily end up in birds' nests and tangles. It can't grow long and lush like princess hair because it starts to break around the time it hits my shoulders. I can't just grow it out and put it in a ponytail for convenience because I don't have enough hair to fill a standard rubber band. I can't keep it in an easy bob either because the shorter it gets, the puffier it gets. My hair always baffled my mother, who cut it short for her own convenience when I was a kid, causing me to constantly be mistaken for a boy, which I hated. And as I grew older, it baffled me too, and thus began my lifelong search all over the world for hairdressers who could do something with my hair. If you've ever seen a picture of me where my hair looks pretty, it's because somebody else did it. Somebody whom I paid to do it. I have spent a fortune, and I don't use the word fortune lightly, to make my hair look pretty over the years. And in my culture, having pretty hair means silky, shiny with golden blonde highlights and a light wave. It took me decades, but I finally found the exact formula that will make my hair look more or less decent most of the time. Daily shampoos, it's that thin hair plus oily skin nightmare that makes me have to wash daily. Monthly highlights, quarterly keratins, treatments, and blowouts for special occasions. And then I can look pretty. Sometimes. The whole situation averages out to about $700 a month, and also involves an enormous amount of time and chemicals. But on the right days, with the right investment and the proper levels of humidity, I could walk out of the house with a look that caused people to say, "I love your hair." But my hair doesn't look like that, actually. It doesn't look like that naturally. What comes to mind now is a line that I've always loved of Dolly Parton's. When someone once asked her if she got offended by dumb blonde jokes, she replied, "No, because I know I'm not dumb, and I also know I'm not blonde." Very few of us, in fact, are blonde. About 2% of the world's population has naturally blonde hair, but over 50% of American women of all races and backgrounds dye their hair some version of blonde. Seems to be a necessity, practically, if you want to be successful, to try to be as blonde as you can possibly be. In a 2016 study about blondness, over a third of America's congresswomen and about 50% of America's female CEOs were reported as blonde. And let's not even talk about television broadcasters. Can you even get an interview for a job at Fox News if you aren't blonde? There's so much garbage and nonsense wrapped up in this, including a somewhat perverse obsession with youthfulness. My highlights were literally called Baby Blonde. Some nasty white supremacy overtones and a widely held misogynistic assumption that blonde women are not only more fun but more friendly and likable and approachable. And I've been part of that foolishness for a long, long time. But I'm getting older, and I'm tired of it. And in recent years, I started fantasizing every day, every single day, about buzzing it all off. I would talk about it with my wonderful hairdresser every month when I spent 2 hours in her chair. One of these days, I would say, I'm going to tell you to grab those clippers and take it all off. Why don't we just give you a nice short and stylish cut? She would ask. And eventually we did do that. But as anyone who has ever had a nice, short, and stylish haircut knows, you have to keep it up. You need those monthly trims to keep the shape of it. It doesn't necessarily make your life any easier. In the end, though, I chopped all my hair off myself. There were two motivating factors that finally gave me the courage to do it. The first was a week I spent with a spiritual teacher of mine, a woman in her early 80s, who is one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen. Her hair is white. Not white like platinum, but white like Mrs. Claus. Her skin is parchment and lined. Her eyes are brilliant and kind. Her hands are covered with age spots. And she is the freest person I have ever met, possessed of the wildest mind. And after a week in her luminous presence, I was like, why am I still pretending that I'm not getting older? Why am I afraid of looking my age? Why does any of this matter at all? What if I just allowed myself to become a gorgeous, old, amazing woman like her? What if I were just free? The second motivating factor was that I attended an event in New York City a few weeks later of about 100 professionals, men and women, all of whom were about the same age as me. Nearly every one of the men in that room had cropped, buzzed, convenient-looking hair. They were all a bunch of silver foxes with lined faces and handsome features, and they all looked great. And every single one of the women in that room had some version of long, extremely expensive-looking, complicated hair, most of which was blonde. And I thought, why are we still doing this? Why has hair become so gendered? This is New York City, one of the most liberal places in the world, and this is a room full of people who all work in the arts, and we still have to follow these stupid rules? That night, I had a realization. I could either complain about how unfair and imbalanced the beauty and aging standards are for men versus women, or just claim for myself the entitlement that these men held. I, too, could just decide to have buzzed hair and a lined face. I, too, could decide to just stop chasing pretty and instead to look great, unadorned, powerful, comfortable, and unfussed over. That did it. The next day, I bought myself some clippers, watched a few instructional videos. Check out a woman known as Gray Hair and Tattoos on YouTube if you want to see some really amazing buzzed hairstyle. And enlisted a friend who used to be a punk to help me with the first swipes of the buzzer over my scalp. It took about 5 minutes, and when I was done, I almost cried. Not because I was horrified by my looks, but for the exact opposite reason. I felt like I had never looked more like myself. I had made this decision because I wanted freedom and convenience, and because I had decided to be post-vanity. But what I saw in the mirror looked like beauty to me. Fierce beauty. That was not what I was expecting. I thought I would look tough and weird and old, and I was okay with that. But when I saw myself with no hair, I thought I looked gorgeous, and I still do. I loved being able to see my whole entire head, my whole entire self. I loved the white and brown and gray speckles that catch the light and sparkle like the scales of a swimming trout. And I loved the way it felt when I rubbed my hand over my scalp, soft and plush like a puppy "This is the most important thing I've ever done in my life," I said to my friend. And maybe that was hyperbole, or maybe it wasn't. It's been 9 months now, and I can't imagine ever growing my hair out again. I love everything about it. Being able to jump in and out of pools, rivers, lakes, oceans, and showers with abandon. Waking up and instantly looking perfect. Getting off the plane from a 12-hour flight and looking perfect. Needing only 5 minutes of prep time before I go on stage and perform. Constantly rubbing my hands over my delicious feeling scalp as if I am my own lucky talisman. Most of all, I love the radical independence that this hairstyle affords me. I've spent more days of my life than I care to count sitting in a chair as if I were some incompetent 18th century aristocrat while others tried to do something with my hair. But now I do it all myself. And yes, each time I buzz my hair away, it feels like a cleansing and like a reclamation of my true spirit. I actually find it weird now to look at pictures of me from when I had hair. The prettier my hair looks in the old pictures, the sadder it makes me feel. To imagine that I gave so much of my time and attention and money to trying to look like something I am not. Something that I am not even sure is attractive, except for the fact that everyone always said it was. A lot of men don't like this haircut of mine, of course, but I find that I don't care. Let me rephrase that. I can't care. I cannot organize my life anymore around what men like. There simply isn't time for it. Some black men like it, I should clarify, which I find really interesting. I was walking down the street in Richmond, Virginia, a few months ago, and four young black men all turned to look at me when I walked by. "Hi, fellas," I said, and one of them replied, "I really like the cut, lady," which totally made my day. Queer women love it, of course, but so do straight, feminine women. In fact, it is the women with the prettiest, most complicated-looking hair who gaze upon my buzz cut with the most longing. "Maybe someday I can have that," they say wistfully, as if I have a castle in the south of France rather than a 5-minute haircut that I give myself every 5 days bent over the toilet. But here's the thing. Most white men don't like it, and I cannot help thinking that is why this haircut is indeed important. It is important because white men should not always get what they want. It isn't good for any of us. The first time I ever posted a picture of myself on social media with my buzzed head, some random bro in the comments wrote, "Why you want to be bald, though?" And it still makes me roar with laughter. That was the ultimate confirmation that I had done the right thing. Dude, I want to be bald because I want to be free. Dude, I want to be bald because I am free. And if you don't get it, sir, that's all the more reason I want it. Over in culture and news, how Governor Gretchen Whitmer keeps her cool in the craziest of times. The author of a new memoir, True Gretch, shares 4 guiding principles we could all use right now. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Gretchen Whitmer has been taunted, teased, and plotted against during her nearly 6 years as Michigan's governor, and she still manages to treat her opposition with decency. The 53-year-old politician who grew up in Lansing speaks with poise and directness, always getting right to the point. But because of her steady Midwestern roots, even her harshest blows land softly. In July, Governor Whitmer published her first book, True Gretch, a compendium of lessons she'd learned as a leader, alongside tidbits from her pre-politics life, like when she threw up on her high school principal after drinking too much at a football game. She was suspended, but later earned her school's Most Improved Student Award. Heading into a divisive election season, we need Governor Whitmer's brand of wisdom more than ever. Here are 4 tools she uses when conflict arises or a conversation goes south. When in doubt, ask questions. I grew up in a household with my dad, who was more of a Republican, and my mom, who was more of a Democrat. I am always thinking about how we find common ground and how we see the humanity in one another and connect as people. It's not always easy, but I have found that when you ask questions, when you listen, when you get to know someone, it's a lot easier to find that common ground and not get distracted by the political rhetoric that seeks to divide us. One of the things my dad always instilled in us is that no one's inherently better than anyone else. Every person is important. If we can focus on values and see one another for who we are, that's where we can bridge that gap. My parents lived that in our household and in their workplaces and in how they raised my brother and my sister and me. Don't take everything personally. Sadly, in the last decade, we've seen this violent rhetoric grow and get normalized, and it's incredibly destructive. I can tell you that any time the former president, Donald Trump, uttered my name or even tweeted about my state, I got more threats. There's a cause and effect there, and it's really crucial that people of goodwill on both sides of the aisle hold one another accountable, not just the people across the aisle, but people within their own parties, too. I've also realized that it's not really about me. That can be difficult because the insults and the ugliness can be very personal. But at the end of the day, the people hurling them, it's really about them and not about me. I'm an ordinary person. I'm in an extraordinary role and in an extraordinary time, but I'm an ordinary person. I have to remind myself of that. Be a happy warrior. The question I get asked the most is how I keep my cool after enduring trauma. Whitmer was the subject of a foiled kidnapping plot in 2020, and it's why I wrote my book. It's 10 things I've learned in my life that have helped me navigate these unprecedented challenges of the last 6 years in office. Don't take things personally, and don't let the bullies get you down. Be the happy warrior. Each chapter has a lesson I've learned on while governing my state through wild, scary, and traumatic situations. I wanted to put something optimistic and hopeful out into the world. Stand in your integrity. I live by what I preach. I walk the walk. I share my philosophy with the people on my team, and I expect that they are a reflection of me. I've been elected on these values, and I expect everyone to live to them. I've got a phenomenal team, and we model, I think, what we hope to see in the world. I think that's the most important thing anyone with a platform or friends or family or coworkers can do. Be the change you want to see. Leadership means recognizing that your role is not about you. It's about other people. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Over in culture and news and books, want to save the planet? Start with joy. In her new book, What If We Get It Right?, marine biologist and policy expert Ayana Elizabeth Johnson, PhD, offers a guide to uncovering your environmentalist superpower and creating real change. This article is by Ayana Elizabeth Johnson. The climate crisis can be overwhelming, feeling so big that we can't imagine where to begin turning things around. I created this book, What If We Get It Right?, as a mosaic of interviews, poetry, essays, and art that are all focused on climate solutions, on the possible futures we could have, and how we, each and every one of us, can help make them happen. If you don't know where to start, the section that follows, one of the final chapters, offers a jumping-off point, and the book offers a full cornucopia of possibilities. If you're ready to dig in further, there's a reading guide, examples of inspiring solutions, and other curated resources online at getitright.earth. One thing is abundantly clear. We can't sit around waiting for someone else to fix this. So as you read on, think about what or what more you can do. To get it right on climate change, we need dreamers. Lean into your imagination. Don't look only at the list of problems. Look also right next to them for the possibilities. Dream not only about the world we want to live in, but also how we can build it together. What's important for the journey ahead? Out with maximizing short-term profits, lollygagging and delay, bankrolling climate pollution, the primacy of shareholders and private property, playing small and individualism. In with ecological regeneration, accountability, doing no harm, relocalizing, justice and collectivism, nature first, community foremost, and with maximal swiftness. Here I'll offer what I believe to be the sexiest word in the English language, implementation, because we already have most of the solutions we need. We, all of us, need to get to work and to pick up the pace. Even though you probably didn't personally do much to cause the climate crisis, we need your help cleaning up this gargantuan mess. We need to build the biggest, strongest team possible to take on this gnarliest challenge humanity has ever faced, and we must do it with gusto. Another word I love that is perfect for this moment is leaderful. Social movements can be fragile when they're helmed by just a few prominent leaders. We need many leaders to accelerate the transformation from an extractive economy to a regenerative one. Maybe you are one of those leaders. And if you don't want to be out front, that's more than okay. It's about being useful and advancing solutions, not about being a hero or an influencer. Well, maybe be an influencer, not in the Instagram model way, but in leading by example. There is a soft power in how you spend your time and money, how you look out for each other, how you roll up your sleeves and make change. What joyous work can you do to help address the climate crisis? How can you be of use? I am thrilled to say this is what I get asked about most these days, and as more and more eyes are wide open. Too often, the climate movement and the media tell everyone to do the same things. Vote, protest, donate, spread the word, and lower your carbon footprint. And yes, it's great to do those things. But all too rarely are we asked to contribute our specific talents, our superpowers. Here's one way to think about what you, specifically you, can do. It's a climate action Venn diagram with three overlapping circles. What are you good at? What are your areas of expertise? What can you bring to the table? Think about your skills, resources, and networks. You have a lot to offer. What work needs doing? Are there particular climate and justice solutions you want to focus on? Think about systemic changes and efforts that can be replicated or scaled. There are heaps of options. What brings you joy? Or perhaps a better word is satisfaction. What gets you out of bed in the morning? Choose climate actions that energize and enliven you. And next, there is a Venn diagram with the three circles. The top circle says what brings you joy, sources of satisfaction and delight. The left circle is what are you good at, skills, resources, and networks. And the circle on the right, what work needs doing, climate and justice solutions. And all of these circles come together in the center with your climate action. For me, a marine biologist, policy nerd, and Brooklyn native worried about sea level rise and climate injustice, my search for this Venn sweet spot led me to co-found Urban Ocean Lab, a policy think tank for the future of coastal cities. It's also how I ended up co-creating the Blue New Deal plan when the Green New Deal all but left out the ocean, and it's how I ended up writing this for you. If we each find that sweet spot that will create way more progress on climate solutions, than if each of us gets sucked into obsessing about our individual carbon footprints. Starting now, reside at the intersection of these three circles for as many minutes of your life as you can. Choose something bigger than yourself, something that can have positive ripples, and don't just diagram your way to what you're already doing. Think about this expansively. Start from scratch to consider where you can have the most impact. Note, this is about action. I've noticed that many people draw their way to some version of communicate about climate, but informing and being informed is not enough. Yes, I fully appreciate the irony, given that I've written an entire book communicating about climate. We need farmers and teachers and mutual aid organizers and green building retrofitters and wind turbine installers and nurses and accountants and engineers and designers and local politicians and project managers and train conductors and activists. Climate change has changed everything. We must remake the world. This doesn't necessarily mean quit your job or go start a nonprofit. A lack of nonprofits is not what's holding us back. Quite possibly, you are most powerful within your existing roles, where you already have specialized knowledge and robust networks, where you have the most power to make significant change through updating processes, protocols, and decision-making frameworks through changing the ways of doing business. We need employees pushing their employers to change. What would it look like to lean into your talents? Could you help your company, school, church, or town charge ahead with climate solutions? Because what we need is change in every sector and in every community. The thing at the center of your Venn diagram can change over time. It certainly has for me, and you can have multiple diagrams at once. I take a portfolio approach to my work, but keep going towards gaps you can fill. My wish for you is that you find your climate purpose and encourage others to find theirs. And here's my advice, guidance I try to follow myself for you to consider along the way. Keep showing up. This is not a spectator sport. It's not just billionaires and politicians who will decide our future. It's small business owners and students and citizens. It's whoever steps up and whoever you bring along with you. Take breaks, but keep going. We shape the future. Bring your superpowers. Be gentle with yourself on the "what are you good at?" question. Put your insecurities aside and simply consider what you have to offer in your personal life, professional life, and civic life. If we each harness our superpowers, that will actually enable the radical changes we need. Join something. Contribute your skills to an existing effort. Make it possible. Build the website. Raise the funds. Recruit the talent. Plan the events. As Bill McKibben puts it, faced with the kind of crisis that we face, the most important thing that an individual can do is to not always be an individual. Move from I to we. Find your people. Someone recently asked me, "Who are your people?" And without a moment of hesitation, directly from my soul came these words. My people are conjurers. They don't stop at dreaming. They make something where there was nothing and something needed. They make magic in the real world. It gives me goosebumps to think how lucky I am to get to say that sincerely. Support your people and love them and hold on. Lean into possibility together. Be a problem solver. What this moment in history requires is a relentless focus on solutions. Whether your purview is finance, energy, urban planning, manufacturing, construction, law, food, administration, or transportation, there's nothing more attractive than a problem solver. Choose your battles. That's how my dad put it. My mom prefers the cornier, "do your best and don't worry about the rest." And it's the best advice my parents have given me. Keep things in perspective by keeping at least one eye firmly on the future of life on Earth. Choose something to fight for, and please, no friendly fire. Nourish joy. There are so many things that need to be done. Don't pick something that makes you miserable. It's imperative to avoid burnout, so choose what enlivens and energizes you. Take climate change seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously. The work can and should be gratifying and punctuated with joy. Love nature. And remember that you are a part of it. I can't say it better than Rachel Carson. Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. Here's what I know. There are innumerable possible futures. I know what we each get some say in which future we'll collectively have and a chance to help build it. I know that every tenth of a degree of warming we prevent, every centimeter of sea level rise we avoid, ever increasingly. A natural disaster we avert, every species we save, every bit of nature we protect and restore matters. I know that our efforts add up and that our fates are intertwined. Averting climate catastrophe, this is the work of our lifetimes. So go where there is need and where your heart can find a home. And when it all feels too much, return to the simple guiding question. What if we act as if we love the future? Be tenacious on behalf of life on Earth. So the book that accompanies this article is What If We Get It Right? By Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. It's now 15% off at $29 at Amazon if you're interested in getting it. Here are some audiobook suggestions. Funny Story by Emily Henry. If you haven't already fallen into the Emily Henry vortex, there's probably no more than a 2-year wait for her books at your public library. The Julia Whelan, and that's pronounced and that's spelled W-H-E-L-A-N, narrated audiobooks could be your gateway drug for fun and funny romances without any dead bodies. Whelan's read all 5 and consistently nails the self-deprecating, ironic, and intelligent voice at the heart of Henry's romantic comedies. This one stars a children's librarian named Daphne, whose fiancé comes home from his bachelor party to announce he's dumping her for his female best friend, Petra. Poor Daphne moves in with Petra's ex, Miles, and guess what happens? This audiobook, Funny Story by Emily Henry, is $18 at Amazon if you're interested. Another one is Harlem Shuffle by Colson Whitehead. Another wildly recognized Uber narrator, Dion Graham, will have you utterly enthralled with his sonorous reading of Superstar Whitehead's crime caper novel, the first in a trilogy. Set in Harlem in the late 50s and 60s, Graham's interpretation of the novel brings its cinematic prose and authentic voices to life in a way you have to hear to believe. Our hero, Ray Carney, is the son of a well-known hoodlum, but he's gone straight. A family man with a used furniture and appliance store on 125th Street. Unfortunately, his ne'er-do-well cousin, Freddie, shows up with an offer he can't refuse. Dion Graham has the kind of voice that could calm screaming infants and mollify mad dogs. Your troubles will be no match. This book is $18 at Amazon. The next suggestion is Lies and Weddings by Kevin Kwan. That last name is spelled K-W-A-N. When Lady Arabella, who was once a supermodel in Hong Kong, schemes to revive her husband, Lord Gresham's tapped-out fortune by marrying their kids to serious generational wealth, a volcano is just the first of the obstacles she confronts. Listening to Jing Lucy perform Kevin Kwan's latest grown-up fairy tale of glitz, glamour, haute couture, fine art, and true love feels like your personal Mary Poppins has parachuted into your life for story time. A Shanghai-born actress, she played Amanda in the Crazy Rich Asians movie. Lucy perfectly voices the posh Brits, expats, and wayward Americans that populate this tale of star-crossed lovers and over-the-top weddings and parties. Pour a glass of the best wine you can afford, sit back, and relax. Lies and Weddings by Kevin Kwan is $20 at Amazon and $11 at Walmart. The next suggestion is The Book of Delights by Ross Gay. If soothing sounds good, but a complete uplift and revival of your heart and soul would be even better, then Ross Gay has a story to tell you. 102 of them were actually created during a year-long experiment in keeping a daily journal of things that the author found delightful. As he puts it, "It didn't take me long to learn that the discipline or practice of writing these essays occasioned a kind of delight radar. The more you study delight, the more delight there is to study. Let Gay's mellow tones flow over you, wrapping you in kindness and good vibes." The Book of Delights by Ross Gay is $17 at Amazon. And lastly, The Waters by Bonnie Jo Campbell. Actress Lily Taylor's winsome reading of Campbell's modern fairy tale makes it sheer audio magic full of timeless wisdom. Her voice, both girlish and authoritative, could not better matched to the story of a family of wise women from a Michigan swamp. The matriarch is herself, Hermine Zook, whose herbal remedies are relied on by the townspeople for everything from hemophilia to unwanted pregnancy, and much of the story is told from the perspective of her 12-year-old granddaughter, a mathematical genius named Donkey. She's in the process of absorbing her grandmother's wisdom when the trigger-happy locals make a terrible mistake. It's $19 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.